And usually kind of could economically support themselves. Otherwise, yes. How would we have heard about them?
Exactly. Yeah. I know Eleanor Rathbone is one of the ones that we kind of always highlight because she really fought for money for women.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, she was fantastic. Eleanor and she Rathbone. Fought actually for refugee rights and,
did
you know,
she?
Against the racism of the day. Yeah, she was really great. And she's the one that brought in family allowance, which was the only money that women could call their own, you know, and was, you know, I'm sure saved many children from starvation.
Child benefits now. Yeah, that's what I remember is having to go to the post office to get my mum's family allowance. And I kept spending it because it was such a lot of money to me. I once bought a cat. I got in real trouble. I pretended to my mum.
You should be interviewed for we are doing this project. Women at the centre are doing this project about what do women remember about family allowance.
Oh, really?
What difference it made before and after getting it, and what difference it made to the family. But buying a cat is a brilliant story.
My poor mum, because obviously my mum desperately needs it. She had three children by herself, and the reason I had to go is because she was at work. There was no time, and she was off work with the post office was open. So yeah, you send your eldest kid and and that kid is just literally going, I'm a millionaire. I can buy everything. I pretended I'd lost the money. I pretended the money flew away and that I'd found a cat while I'd looked for it. I know. What an awful girl.
Hello and welcome to Sex Power Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. Today I'm talking to Nikki and Laura, who are spokeswomen for the English Collective of Prostitutes, an amazing organisation of sex workers working both on the streets and indoors, which campaigns for decriminalisation and safety. Today we're going to be discussing politicians, the police, and the current laws affecting sex work around the world.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk to me. So, the English Collective of Prostitutes...
Collective.
What did I say? Collection. It's a collection of prostitutes. It's a prostitute collection. Yeah. A collective of prostitutes. So how long has the organisation existed?
We've been going since 1975.
Yes.
I haven't personally, others in the organisation have.
Yes. And, yeah. And in terms of setting it up, what was the need at the time?
The organisation was set up by two migrant sex workers based in the UK, in London, who were looking around. There was a lot of sex workers being arrested constantly by the police.
Yeah.
A lot of violence from clients happening that wasn't being dealt with by the police. You know, when women came forward to report the violence, nothing was happening. And there was a need, actually, to change something and for sex workers to be able to say something about their own situation and what they wanted changing. And so, yeah, they set up the organisation.
Yeah.
And they looked around for support or help from women's organisations and were told to get lost by most organisations except one.
Oh, really? There was one good one.
Yes, one organisation, the Wages for Housework campaign, founded by Selma James, who we're still based at our women's centre with, who was interested and... came together and...
Yeah, so Wages for Housework doesn't really get talked about very much anymore. Does it?
Well, it does to the extent that I think people know now that the whole issue of caring work is really massively important and that the fact that caring work is unpaid for means that it's devalued in society. And I think there is a big and growing movement to change that, to say that caring should be central.
Yes.
You know, the reproduction of the human race is really crucial. I mean, for us, it's a very obvious connection because, you know, if women were paid for the work that we do, raising children and keeping society together, we wouldn't be pushed into prostitution.
Absolutely.
You know, in order to feed our children. I mean, the majority of sex workers are mothers.
Yeah.
And that's a really primary motivation.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a lot to kind of go against the law, you know, to decide, I'm going to be an illegal worker.
Yeah, put yourself outside of society,
exactly.
Which is still a kind of positioning. That's why I found it so interesting that there's such political engagement, but there has to be for people who are literally ostracised from so many areas of society just because of the way that they earn their money.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That is right. I mean, I think the other thing about when we started as an organisation, there was a very big struggle of sex workers in France at the time.
Was there?
And there's a brilliant film actually about it, where the women are actually speaking about the situation, and everything they say is true now.
Yes.
You know, they say we're mothers, you know, working to support our kids. Mm. We don't get protection from the police. You know, we end up in, you know, suffering violence and don't get any protection. The laws are criminalizing us. We get criminal records and we're trapped in prostitution. All those kind of issues. And they actually went into, they occupied churches throughout the whole country and really brought to public attention. I mean, we heard about it here.
Yeah,
and that was kind of a big inspiration for us starting up. It was a very big movement, and there was a lot of clarity and power that came at that time.
They're really good at striking, France. Like, they are amazing at that, aren't they? At their revolutions.
I know the mothers that are involved in the Gilets Jaunes are really fantastic as well.
Okay.
You know, they've been kind of out there protesting police of violence and abuse.
I think people would be shocked and should be shocked by the way the police treat sex workers, because it's a pretty bad situation. It's a bit like, at the moment, every kind of act that every kind of contact that sex workers have with the police is hostile. And, you know, on the street, if you're working on the street or if you're working from a flat, the police are kind of constantly on your back, constantly arresting you, stopping you, raiding you.
And then, what kind of training do the police get in terms of working with sex workers? Because also, surely the legal position now, so the current legal state for someone selling sex by themselves in Britain is that it's decriminalized. Is that right?
No,
it's not. Okay.
I mean, it's not illegal to be a sex worker, but everything you fundamentally do to contact a client is illegal.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, that, so working on the street is illegal. You get done for loitering and soliciting. You also increasingly get done under these new civil orders, you know, all the kind of antisocial behaviour orders or public space protection orders, which are very draconian.
Yes.
But it's also illegal to work together from premises.
Yes, so that's something I found really surprising, because it makes such common sense.
Exactly.
If someone, for economic or safety reasons or both, would share a premises with other people working, it just seems to be the most sensible thing in the world. But our law at the moment says that's brothel keeping. And everyone can then be,
that's
illegal.
And that brothel keeping law is used mostly against women working from premises. It's not used against the people that are coercing or forcing people, because it doesn't mean, you know, you don't need any to prove any kind of force or coercion to get. And it's a very serious sentence. It's like 7 years in prison is the maximum sentence for brothel keeping.
Yeah. And it doesn't make a lot of sense, because people assume, again, from a position of ignorance, that those laws are there to protect the very vulnerable people. I found it very interesting that in terms of places that have anti-trafficking laws, they've only ever really been used against people for trafficking themselves.
Yeah.
They're just, again, using it against a sex worker, not ever against a trafficker, what we would think of as a kind of evil pimp person.
Yeah, that's really true. Lots of women in our group have been raided and arrested. You know, migrant sex workers raided and arrested under the whole guise of anti-trafficking. I mean, the biggest raids were in 2013 in Soho, where 250 police came down.
Yes.
And the whole PR around that was to save victims of rape and trafficking. And no victims were found, but many women were thrown out of their premises.
They took their money, didn't they?
They handcuff
women, and then in some other cases they kind of interview you for 4 hours, and then they say about your immigration status, how many clients you see, how much you earn, and then at the end they go, oh, no, you trafficked. So it just, they're not interested really in actually finding or helping victims, because that's not how you would.
Well, it isn't how you would, is it?
No.
I mean, you wouldn't drag people out and have the press there and humiliate them. And wouldn't.
Not the best anti-trafficking strategy we've heard of.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because in terms of trigger words for the public, or whether it's going to make them read a newspaper, or it's something that's so emotive for people, because the idea, which is not a common reality, but it is a horrific thing to hear about or imagine.
Exactly.
The idea of someone being taken or tricked by a boyfriend or offered a job in one country and actually it's not in a kitchen, it's in a brothel. That idea for people is so emotive that it actually obliterates all of the sensible conversation about choices and migrancy and transactional sex.
It has been deliberate, though. You know, I do think so. I mean, we've seen it over many years now, and the whole putting forward these statistics that 80% of sex workers are trafficked was actually a deliberate ploy.
Yes.
And it was in order to bring in legislation that actually ended up cracking down on sex workers and make it easier for the police to close premises. And on the question of the police, I think that you asked about training. I don't know that it's a question of training. I think, first of all, we have to get rid of the laws that give the police the discretion to abuse people in that way, and would also encourage the better officers to actually clean up their act, you know, clean up the police's act, because I do think the police are split on the issue. Mm. I think some police officers recognise that criminalisation does increase danger and that, you know, police raids don't help and all the rest of it. But also, I think we have to remember on your question, on your point about the just society, is that what it's called?
Yes, the just world
hypothesis. Just world.
Yeah.
You know, the thing we always struggle with is it's the same police. It's the same police that kind of kill people in custody and get off, you know, with impunity.
Yeah.
It's the same police that are picking up young black men in particular on the street. You know, it's not a different police force that they somehow bring out to police sex workers.
Yes.
And so the idea that some of the proposals are to increase criminalisation, which would increase the powers of the police, how can that be sensible?
Yeah.
You know, it's the same police. We know we have to deal with the abuse and we have to deal with the fact that they have all this discretion and power under the prostitution laws to criminalise and persecute people.
Yes. I wanted to talk about, ask you about Foster and Sesta, but something to ask you beforehand is, so another, I think, common misapprehension for people is that it is possible for terrible things to happen when a sex worker is alone with a client, and people all know about sex workers being murdered or assaulted, and that's a reality. And they think, well, how great then? We'll make it completely illegal. We'll bring in all of these laws to protect the people from the very bad men. and what we don't realise, it's all back to front, is that actually the more dangerous it is for, or societally, for someone to pay for sex, the more hidden it is, the more anonymous, the darker the car park, the more hidden.
Exactly.
What you do is you make it more and more dangerous for the person who their form of income is selling that sex. You don't get rid of it. What you do is make their life more difficult. And I think that's the thing that should be so much more widely acknowledged.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And also we have a lot of women have said to us that when they have been attacked by violent men who are just taking advantage of the situation, the fact that it's a criminalised setting, because the guys know that there's nothing that women can do about it, or if they do go and report, the police will tell them to go away or threaten them with prostitution, being arrested for prostitution themselves. And the guys full well know that, and that's why they...
So it gives them a safety, the bad people,
They know nothing's going to happen to them.
Yes.
So that's also a massive piece of our work, is getting the police to actually deal with the violence that's happening.
So, the thing that it would make perfect sense is that someone who assaults a sex worker because they feel that they can, they're not necessarily a good person elsewhere in society. They should be of real interest to the police, because those people tend to either commit domestic violence, intimate partner violence, rape or assault other people. Often it's the accessibility of the women that's doing it.
Absolutely.
Or kind of giving them a recourse. You'd think that would be great, red flag. We found one because someone's come in and reported him,
You would think that, but I mean, you know, like some of the women in our group, you know, one woman was robbed at knife point by five men. And when she reported it, the police initially showed a bit of interest. As soon as they realised it was a brothel, they ignored all the information she gave about the violent men and came back immediately with a letter threatening her with prosecution. And that's happened over and over again to women in our group.
Yes.
And I think that the anti-trafficking issue is connected in some ways, because I think that the anti-trafficking has been used as a cover to raid and arrest sex workers, particularly migrant sex workers.
Yes.
It's kind of a law and order proposal or, you know, agenda. And I think, you know, the police get extra money for anti-trafficking. The way that they prove that they're being effective against against trafficking is to be seen to be raiding premises.
Yes.
And that is the battleground that we're up against at the moment. Because we're saying every time you raid somewhere, even when you say it's a welfare visit, I don't know how they quite get away with that when it's, you know, 25 police officers turning up on your door, and they call it a welfare visit.
They call it a welfare visit. So what is that pretending to be? Or what is it supposed to be? Checking you're okay.
Yeah. Hello, is everyone okay?
No, they do. They really? Come in and say, is everything okay? Are you all right?
Need any condoms?
Then when we complain that they're terrorising women,
yes,
you know, because then they come in and take all your details. Mm. I mean, why would you want to give your details in that situation? You
For
know,
sure, it's like yeah. you're So working... it doesn't make people feel safer. Like, oh, they're all 25 of them barged in. I feel so
and
looked
posing,
after.
Posing as clients as well, which is
yes, which is like a sting.
Outrageous.
Like, yeah. Yeah. yeah.
So I think it's, you know, that is really the battleground that we're up against at the moment. But I think the other issue is that really has to be addressed, because at the moment, you know, people are looking at this kind of criminal justice approach. But in fact, prostitution is increasing because of the massive rise in poverty.
Yes. So that's
and,
so
you
that's
know, if
the
you
biggest
want to do something
indicator.
About
yeah.
prostitution, do something about that.
That's,
you know,
that's kept coming up. Actually, the people I've been talking to, we've been talking about kind of feminists who are maybe anti-sex worker, anti-porn. And really the biggest conversation, if you want to help people, is help people in abject poverty. Societally, we have to have better structures in place. The state has to have better structures in place. Lots of talk, you know, about kind of, was it like universal
credit? Yeah, I mean, they should abolish those measures that have been shown to make people poorer, particularly women.
And,
I mean,
and also the admin involved that then means there's a series of weeks in between, or, you know, someone being late and...
Destitute for weeks and weeks. We just gave evidence to the Work and Pensions Committee about the whole issue of survival sex. Some women in our group actually spoke about their own experience, and then we gave evidence as a group as well. And it's been something we have been going on about for such a long time now, you know, really seeing practically how the increase in poverty is translating into more women going into prostitution, but also women who had managed to leave having to go back into prostitution. The whole issue of sanctions, even before the issue of universal credit, because sanctions and universal credit, the difference about that is that it actually leaves people destitute.
Yes.
I mean, you literally have no money to buy your next meal.
Yeah.
And what did they think was going to happen? I mean, we're in this kind of argument, or we were in, you know, in a kind of fight with the government, because the government was kind of saying, well, you know, our intention is to help people. And we're saying, no, but you put in a policy that deliberately makes people destitute.
Yes. Yes.
You know, you planned this.
Yes.
And now you're pretending to be surprised at the result. And that's just not good enough. And I feel like, you know, on the question of feminists, they should get together with us and demand that those policies be abolished.
Yes.
We'll discuss everything else afterwards.
Because actually, that's a separate thing to anyone's morality, what their personal feelings are, experience. It's like the actual basic thing. Because I know that some people are very sex positive, and so like the argument that, well, sex work is work, but that doesn't take away from the poverty is poverty.
Exactly.
Bottom line of it.
Yeah. I mean, sex work is work, and it is true that a lot of women go into sex work because the other jobs are so rubbish.
Yes. And that's what a choice is. If someone has made a decision between two things, then that is a choice.
I mean, it's terrible in some ways, because we did this report called What's a Nice Girl Like You Doing in a Job Like This?
Which people get asked a lot, don't they? And strippers get it as well. And like, but you're quite clever, aren't you? You could.
You get told you're not a prostitute because you're too articulate. You know, it's like, that's really a common.
People have an expectation.
But we did this report, and it did literally compare other kind of women's jobs with sex work.
Yes.
And, you know, low pay, exploitative conditions, injury at work, abuse at work by bosses was widespread across the biggest difference is that sex workers got paid more per hour.
Yes. And so just to clarify what those jobs are, things like kind of cleaning.
Cleaning, hairdressing, but even midwifery, you know, housing support officer, teachers, you know, because the public sector jobs, which people would expect that you could have a decent standard of living on, the cuts have meant that that's not possible any longer. But also some of those women were describing that they were expected to work such long overtime that their actual hourly rate
kind of
dropped down below the minimum wage in some cases.
Yes.
It's just shocking.
The other thing about the report was that the thing that was different between the jobs that were not criminalised, if you see what I mean, except for those jobs where it was kind of very low pay, 0 hour contracts, but the more kind of public sector jobs, if something had gone wrong, there was some kind of mechanism for a complaint to be taken forward.
Yes.
And that was kind of the massive difference between those jobs and prostitution, for example, where there was no mechanism because it was criminalised and there was kind of nothing you could do about it, really. And I think that was a big kind of difference.
So you weren't even, you were kind of not even able to tackle the kind of violence and exploitation within sex work because of your criminal status. You know, people complain about violence and exploitation in sex work, but the criminalisation actually prevents sex workers, who are the most effective people, you know, the people that would be most effective at tackling it, from prevents us from really kind of acting.
Yeah. So it is, the hands are tired. So to talk about Foster and Sester, because it's something that has affected obviously sex workers in America hugely. And because I thought you guys would be the best people to talk to about kind of the different legal situations across the world, because there's several situations kind of going on at once with lots of people arguing pros and cons for each. And I figured you'd be the most qualified. So Foster and Sester, something under the Trump government, have gotten a kind of very conservative ruling under, again, this umbrella of trafficking, haven't they? So obviously there were some real horror stories of things that had gone on and things that had happened, murders to people who were trafficked or underage, on advertised on back pages where sex workers were advertising. And they've used that now to... So it's now illegal to advertise. All of those kind of pages have closed down. And people who are using the internet to kind of look at their, like, check screen, their clients, screen, that's the word, screen their clients and check. So they had some kind of level of choice and safety. That's all been taken away from them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happened. We have a sister organisation in San Francisco called the US Prostitutes Collective. So we have a good idea of what's kind of happening on the ground.
Yeah.
And violence has increased massively since that law against sex workers, since the law was introduced.
So sex buyers know straight away you're more vulnerable. Yeah. Or their power has suddenly increased exponentially, from where it was. Okay.
Yeah, and on those kind of websites, there's all kinds of safety, basic kind of safety mechanisms that you want to be implemented, including, you know, getting to know someone a little bit before you meet them.
Yes, you can email someone back and forth.
Exactly, and you can even try and speak to them on Skype, or you can... ask for more details. You know, there's lots of things. There's also reviews of people, so you can see what other people have said.
Because that's
that
obviously
person.
A very important thing in terms of communicating. Is it that is. Actually, if someone, a polite phrase I've heard someone use is boundary pusher, which obviously is a maybe it's a shade before violent assault. So boundary pusher. But there's a way, if you've got a way of communicating, if you have networks, then you can say, this is their car registration, they call themselves this.
And they're trying it on, or they're a time waster, or you don't want anything to do with them. All that kind of stuff is all online in a much more easily accessible way than if you're working on the street, for example, when you're not working online at all. So, yeah, it's just all completely disappeared. They're trying to introduce something similar here as well.
Yeah, so I noticed that, because with pornography, some of the laws that are coming in are, everything's moving to the right in terms of being more conservative. And again, it's under umbrella of like cleaning up society or protecting our kids. And so I think lots of people assume that it must be positive. Like,
But though that the pornography stuff is really also pushing everything into the hands of big business, and that has been a move throughout the sex industry. So, for example, after the Soho, the raids in 2013 in Soho, generally the sex industry there had been run by women. You know, a lot of it was sex workers themselves working together from premises, and often the maid or the receptionist would have been a former sex worker, and it was very much a women-run business. And after the raids, you know, it kind of gives an invitation for the gangsters to move in. And so women were paying more, were working in much more exploitative circumstances, and, you know, heavy men, you know, gangster-type guys kind of took over. And often that's what happens actually on the street as well, is that if you're constantly being arrested and cannot rely on the police for protection, you're often pushed into the hands of somebody, somebody who comes along and says, pay me to give you protection. You have a lot less power to be able to resist that. And I think that's what's happened with the pornography as well, with the age verification process. It means if you make the process, you know, expensive and complicated, all the kind of small independent operators that are often sex worker run and much more ethical and protective of people's safety, they end up getting pushed out of business. It yes. happened with the dancers in 2010 with the Policing and Crime Act that changed the licensing.
Oh, tell me about this because I don't know about it.
Well, in 2010, there was a Policing and Crime Act. It had a few measures, and the one that everybody focused on and that feminist campaigners, including within Parliament, pushed for, was that it brought in an offence to increase the criminalisation of clients. It was a ridiculous offence. It yes. said it was paying for sex with a prostitute forced or coerced, which on the face of it sounds dreadful.
Yes.
Of course, who would, you know, yes. not want that to be criminalised? Yes. But it was a strict liability offence. So it meant that if the man, no matter what the man did to find out about the situation of the woman, he was still guilty if she was later found out to be coerced in any way. And the definition of coercion was very wide.
Well, coerce itself as a word is interesting.
Yes.
Because it's broad, it's subjective, it can be retrospective. I mean,
that's right.
All of us are coerced by society,
yeah.
like every single day. I mean, every single economic decision we make is some form of coercion.
Most of us don't work because we love it.
No.
we wouldn't do it if we weren't getting paid for it.
Exactly. You coerced me to buying that sandwich because I was hungry and you opened a shop there, pret-a-manger. Like, there are so many ways to interpret it, which is not to be flippant about coercion in sex.
No, but so they had this offence, and that's the one that got all the headline news. Behind that, what was also in the bill was a couple of things. One, that made it easier for the police to arrest women on the street by changing the definition of soliciting.
Okay.
One that made it easier for them to close down premises using closure orders. Mm. And then the third was to change the licensing for so-called lap dancing clubs. And they put up the price and made the whole procedure much more difficult to navigate. And at that time, like, there was a lot of women in our group who were working as strippers in small collectives.
Yes.
They would literally hire a venue, you know, organise something, and people were,
earning
a reasonable...
And you advertise it, and they collect the cash from people.
And if you make it that you need a licence for £30,000 upwards, all that kind of business just disappears.
Like you say, that's the independence that people
it is, and that's what we want. I mean, that's the reason that we've got, the campaign Make All Women Safe, which is pressing for two things. Mm. It's highlighting the injustice that even though it's not illegal to be a sex worker, it is illegal to work together.
Yes.
And we want the law to be changed so that sex workers on the street and working together in premises are decriminalised. We also want criminal records expunged because that's a really massive...
Also, again, it's an interesting thing. So I don't think the majority of people want sex workers to be punished. You've pulled a face. So we'll get to that in a second if you think so. Okay, so maybe like my friendship group, let's take them. They would not want ever sex workers to be punished. But what they don't understand about a criminal record is it is a form of punishment. And so it limits everything that you do afterwards, whether you want to go travel to certain countries, but employment more importantly, which is what everyone needs to survive. So you actually limit somebody's options if they have a criminal record from something that you think they shouldn't have been using to get money in the first place.
Yeah.
And so you keep people in prostitution or selling sex.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's the experience of a lot of women in our group who haven't even been able to apply for other jobs because they don't even want the possibility of anyone knowing that they've got a criminal record.
Yes.
And sometimes, you know, even if you think, well, people might be more sympathetic to the word prostitution on your record, sometimes it just says sexual offence.
Mm.
So it could be...
It says sexual offence as a crime,
which is horrendous.
Yes.
And it does follow you around forever and stops people from leaving. It really does. And so... Yeah, we just want them.
We were speculating why they had a rule that a prostitute caution stays on your record until you're 100.
Oh,
we thought that maybe
102. No, I'm too tired. I'm not going to sell sex anymore. Do you know why? I'm knackered, actually. I'm going to retire.
They thought maybe that was the retirement age for sex workers.
There's probably old women in the homes raking it in.
Not worrying about that caution
waiting
anymore.
Waiting for their 100th birthday to come so they can run out again. And
yes, finally. I'm clean, guys. I can start again. Yeah.
Oh, God. I can apply for another job.
That's it. No, I'm finally be a teacher. I can finally be a teacher now. Now that it's gone. I find all of this legal stuff so fascinating because I think, like a lot of people, I just didn't know it was happening. Or I might see pictures of a raid going on in 2013 in Soho, but I don't know. I didn't know that thing about the licensing laws for strip clubs, because even when it's not collectives, it's the dancers who are paying for that.
Exactly.
They're paying for it. It's never ever the business owner. It's all passed on to workers. And one thing I've learned, I was talking to Joanna, and she's a brilliant activist and stripper, and one of the things that I found really interesting is that there's certain jobs where, and actually comedy, my job's a bit like this, where you're always at the behest of employers. So my job is relatively empowered, but only if people want to work with you. And the minute they decide not to, there's no recourse. But if you're a stripper, someone else decides your shifts or decides I'm never going to employ you again. And that can be very similar for a cleaner who complains about working conditions or someone who just asks for more money. There's just certain jobs where you have so little worth. You're told, I've got millions of other people will take your place. And that's why we all have to work together.
It's so true.
And across employment as well.
I mean, that's why we did the research really comparing sex work to other jobs, because one of the things I was astonished at was, you know, since the introduction of zero-hour contracts, women's negotiating power, in particular women, because it's a lot of women that are on those zero-hour contracts, it's like your negotiating power with your boss is completely reduced. It's like you're having to renegotiate your contract every single minute of the day because you're always watching out to keep a good relationship, to ensure that you even get enough hours next week for you to be able to eat.
Yes.
And that, I mean, they think that that has nothing to do with sex work. That has everything to do with sex work, because if that's the conditions of work in non-sex working jobs, so many more women are going to end up having to do sex work because you just cannot make a living in other ways.
No, and also, but the idea that no one has a right to make a living, the idea that no one has a right to knowing what hours they're working the next week. My sister, when she was pregnant, worked in a bar, and that's a classic 0 hours contract where they just, and because it's illegal to sack a pregnant woman, but it's not illegal to give her 0 hours for the rest of her time working with you. And one of my friends is heavily pregnant. She works for The Guardian on a 0 hours contract. Like, it's everywhere.
It is everywhere.
Because they make more money that way. They have all of the power. And yet they just shouldn't be legal, should they?
No, really, they should. They should really be abolished. And it's the same as the connection between, you know, benefits and the social kind of security net.
Yes.
That, you know, you hope that people save people from destitution, because, you know, I feel like the unions and other people that are involved in kind of labour rights, I mean, we do have some support from the trade unions, but not enough. And I think that, you know, the connection between the way that they cut wages and or workers' powers to insist on better wages is so connected to what benefits you get if you're not, you know, if you're forced into unemployment.
Yeah.
If you can't, if you're going to starve,
yes,
then you're going to take any job at any condition, at any wage, put up with any kind of exploitation. And the labour movement really, you know, the trade union movement has to really address that. Some people are. The Bakers Union is brilliant.
Oh, really? The Bakers Union?
Yeah. And they're really working to fight against the zero-hour contracts.
Yes.
And, you know, like ASLEF, the Train Drivers Union, supports decriminalisation. They've been a really good, you know, friend and supporter.
Yeah.
And some of the other unions are kind of getting on board. But some of the bigger unions still have this position that sex work is uniquely exploitative and they really need to look at what's going on in the world.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because some people's morality or just an early learned narrative is so difficult to overcome. That something I've been realising again and again is that lots of us have an emotive reaction to certain things. And sex work is definitely emotive for some people. And we trust our emotions as correct. So I feel it must be wrong, so it is wrong, without any more kind of thinking. The idea that you guys reaching out to another union and they'll go, oh...
Yeah,
we can't really be seen to be in cahoots with you because,
that's definitely what we've come across, because we were trying to, for ages, work out, like, what is the problem? I mean, we have, you know, it's a basic kind of right to be able to work together. And there's lots of other jobs that people say, you know, you should really work with someone else. You shouldn't just work on your own. So why is it kind of different for sex workers? And I think what it came down to with some women, we found out, was that they just thought it was a bit icky. And
that was actually a quote, by the way.
It's a bit icky, isn't it?
And we were a bit kind of like,
Since when is that the basis? Since when should that be the basis of you deciding your kind of position on somebody's rights and safety is that you find what they do?
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of really
going
dreadful...
down a coal mine. Bit dusty, actually. Yeah. A bit dusty, that's so. So I'm not going to go.
Not going to support the
workers. If you want to go down there, fine. But I'm not going to talk to you about working hours.
I know. So I mean, that's a really good, you know, comparison in some ways, because there's a lot of jobs that are dreadful. You know, they're also very injurious to people's health and the rest of it. And what do you do in those situations?
Yes.
You try and make sure that the workers have better rights and more power and higher wages and more choices, you know.
Absolutely.
We always say, you know, some of us don't think McDonald's is a fabulous institution or corporation, but it's that doesn't mean that our kind of response to the workers is like, well, we don't like the company, so therefore we are not going to support you in any way. And it's a bit like that's how... But like the people that are doing it to us wouldn't do it in any other industry or in any other situation. It's like it's kind of focused on sex workers.
Actually, I do think similar. There's a different kind of stigma, but I think people who have a very low income, I think people who've never been poor, who've never had to make certain decisions, I do think there's a snobbery, whether it's conscious or unconscious. I think they assume stupidity. I think they do assume. You know, like politicians will quite often say something, you know, like when they don't know the price of milk, or they'll just make a sweeping statement and you go, oh, you've never been there. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, here's a common one when people think, well, why do they spend all that money on cigarettes if they're so poor? Or why do they drink? All you have to do is stop drinking. Yeah. And then everyone can afford to live on £35 a week. Like that whole psychology, I think quite often there's empathy failure. Or just logistically not even going into it very much.
Yeah, I think it's a class issue. You know, I think that, I mean, we've seen that with some of the feminist politicians who are very kind of self-righteous about pushing forward measures that will actually make our lives more difficult and dangerous.
Yeah.
And you definitely get the impression that they think that they know better. Mm. They think that they know better what's good for us than we do.
Yes.
And they definitely, you know, they kind of talk about sex work as uniquely degrading, but not poverty as uniquely, not being able to feed your children as uniquely degrading and humiliating and desperate and the rest of it. And so they have a hierarchy. And I think it's really a class kind of division in a lot of ways. I think that's what's been helpful about all the publicity about the survival sex that's been coming out.
Yes.
Is that, or not, we don't particularly like that expression.
It's an interesting expression, isn't it? Because then it gives someone no autonomy at all. And it excuses someone. It's like, look, no one would want to do it, but this person, just to actually not be dead, has done it. So we can say, okay, that's awful society. That person's had to do that thing.
Which is ridiculous because, I mean, a lot of the women in our group immediately said, well, you know, I'm working so that I can pay my mortgage and don't lose my house. I do really think that's quite a survival issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, actually. I think the difficulty with everything around sex is there are certain things that are popular or unpopular, and it just means that there is no integrity around who will stand with sex workers and who won't.
Except that the kind of support for decriminalisation is growing. I think there's been a few things that have really helped. I think that people have seen that criminalisation actually undermines safety, and people are genuinely worried about safety, which I think is, you know, it really speaks well of people, you know, of the public.
Yeah.
And I think the whole issue of the cuts and how austerity has targeted women and the information that has come out about people being destitute, you know, people do really, that's also shifted a lot of people's point of view. So they feel like if you're going to do something about that.
Yes.
I don't really want to know about the other stuff. Yes. Just do something about
that.
That's
great. Okay, so
and I think we found the Make All Women Safe campaign has been a very good way of kind of approaching some of the politicians who did not know much about sex work and didn't really want to think about it. But it's a very simple kind of proposal. Look, it's much safer to work together. Change the law, let sex workers work together and deal with the criminal records that will help people get out of prostitution.
Yes.
And I think that that is being a kind of a more palatable and understandable and kind of...
Well, also,
you know,
I guess sometimes what really helps with people is having things broken down into really understandable chunks, because actually there's a lot of legality and history around that people have heard all of these different words. So actually this is quite a good point for me to ask you about what's going on in different countries. And because obviously, you've got New Zealand and Australia or Melbourne, and so their situations are that it's kind of state legalised or no? No.
I was actually just going to say the other thing that's been really, really crucial to us is New Zealand.
Okay.
Which New Zealand in particular, who decriminalised in 2003.
So that's decriminalised. So it's not legalised, as in, so not, you're not like on a register if you sell sex or anything
like
that.
No, you're not on a register. It's prostitution was completely removed from the criminal law.
Great.
And it's much more the kind of model that we want here.
Okay.
And
so what's the difference between decriminalising and legalising?
So decriminalisation, as they have in New Zealand, the criminal laws that criminalise prostitution and sex workers are taken out.
And that's all of them.
Law.
So that's the one about kind of having the money to get it, but also the soliciting and the working together. All of those things
all
aren't
of those
on the
things
legal.
Taken yeah. out. Okay. Obviously, violence is not decriminalised.
No.
And neither is force and coercion or anything like that. They are all yes. left on the statute.
Still, but that would be crimes in any kind of sex.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So exactly just, as any other kind of sex, if you're forced, coerced or been violent,
exactly.
regardless of the money, that's illegal.
Yeah. yeah. So it's just, yeah, the loitering, soliciting and working together. And also in New Zealand, criminal records were expunged as well for sex workers.
Yeah.
And so those laws were taken out and replaced by health and safety legislation for sex workers.
Okay.
And the legislation was actually campaigned for and led by sex workers.
Right.
So it's very good legislation in terms of workers'
rights.
Because
they listened to what people needed yeah, and wanted.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
As opposed to legalisation, for example,
okay.
Which is in various different countries.
Because I think lots of people, I think I've said in one of these podcasts, one of the people's like, I'm really pro-legalisation. I was like, yeah, me too, because I think I've yeah. conflated
people
all
think,
of those
yeah,
things.
Exactly.
So it's really great to have them explained to me by someone who understands. So the situation in Amsterdam, is that legalisation?
Yes.
And that means that the state take tax? Is that part of it?
Yeah.
It always comes up in arguments, by the way. People go, and then we can tax them. So it's actually very legitimate because then we can tax them. All
well,
this tax
first
money.
We're already paying tax most of the time.
Yes, absolutely.
And also, we always have, we have a slogan, no taxation without civil rights. You
yes.
know, give us our rights and we'll pay tax.
Yeah. I think it's just that people then suddenly think, it's so legitimate. Imagine all the great tax money. Yeah.
I know, women pay so much money in fines and proceeds of crime that I think we're paying enough taxes
yes.
to cover
yes.
ourselves for many years to come.
Yes. So in Amsterdam,
yes.
which is, and actually for most like British people, that will be the place that they will have seen prostitution, people, sex work will be this very visual kind of women in windows. Yeah.
Yeah. It's state-run prostitution, basically. So the state decides what is legal and what is not. The criminal laws are not taken off out of the
okay, so they're still
criminal records.
Exist.
They're still in place. It's just that the state says, okay, in this small area, you're allowed to work under these circumstances that we decide.
Okay.
And we're going to, you have to register with your local whatever.
Yes. And there are things that are very restrictive about that and obviously don't work in the... for the worker.
That's
the
right.
work against them, so other people can still, there are still obviously horrible stories of exploitation
yeah,
or
very
sort of
much
migrant
gives power
workers.
To the bosses
yes.
because you don't have the alternative to work outside of those areas.
Yes.
You know, like here, oh sorry, like
yes.
in New Zealand,
yeah.
If you got treated badly in a brothel,
yeah.
you could just go and say, well, look, I'm sorry, I'm going to go and set up with my mate and we'll work from
yeah.
a flat together.
Yes.
You don't have that option, and that is a really crucial thing in terms of how much power you have against exploitation
okay.
and abuse.
Okay, so there's obviously huge negatives to that where people might think, oh, it's so positive, they're allowed to work, where actually it's incredibly restrictive. And then people talk about the Swedish, Nordic model.
Mm-hmm.
So the Nordic model, is that's something where the people buying the sex are criminalised, but not the people selling sex, is that right?
Well, in theory.
In theory.
in theory, yes, that they say, you know, all prostitution is violence and therefore should be stopped.
Yes.
And to stop it, we have to... criminalise the buyer so that demand reduces. That's the kind
yes.
of theory behind
and
it.
And that's the thinking that lots of feminists that I read or that I follow on Twitter and think is great, because some people's problem with decriminalising is that, but there are these awful men who do awful things, or they extend that out to, if some women are selling sex and the entirety of like womanhood is suppressed by it, that men can't tell the difference between... well, that woman's a glamour model, so I want to see that woman's boobs. so that morality means that, okay, we're not going to attack, they don't want to attack or blame women who want to sell sex for whatever reason, but they do still blame the men. But actually that does affect the people selling sex.
Exactly.
Lives. Yes.
And it's a fundamental mistake because, you know, the demand for prostitution is not fueled by men's desire for sex. It's women's desire, you know, women's need for money.
Mm.
You know, so if you want to do something about the proliferation of prostitution,
yes.
do something to ensure that women have choices not to go into the sex
that's
industry.
That's such an incredible soundbite. I'm just saying that for them recording up there, because that's what you've just summarised. Yeah. Because I think, myself included, my whole interest in this was like, when I very first became interested, it was like, why do men think they can buy women? Because I was thinking about, I really like Idris Elba. I think he's an incredible actor, very handsome man. But if you said, oh, you can pay to have sex with him. He doesn't want to have sex with you, but you can pay him to. I wouldn't want to. Like, the idea would be so horrible. So my interest came from that point. Like, what's wrong with these men? But switching it on it, but switching it on its head and going, there's women who need money. That's far more interesting to think about. Yeah,
it is. I mean, it is the way. And it undercuts all of those discussions. And it really, I mean, you know, the thing about New Zealand is that as soon as it was decriminalised, women had much more power, you know, they, including to refuse to be sex workers and to refuse clients.
I refusing really feel, clients is interesting,
exactly,
isn't it?
Because I think it's a really key thing. It's like the litmus test of how exploitative your working conditions are.
Yeah.
And if you can refuse clients, and the majority of sex workers in New Zealand say that they now have the power to refuse clients, that's just massive.
It's huge. I was reading about, I'm pretty sure it was here, but a group of sex buyers got together to drive down the price of the women selling sex, and which is the complete reversal of that, is that they knew they need the money, so we're going to haggle them down, because when we stop the cash flow, we're creating desperation.
On and the flip side of
you would say about the women,
same story. It's actually one of the women in our group actually went around the flats that she knew. She was working in a flat, and she went around the other local flats that she knew of, saying, "Let's all put up the prices." With all the other women, which is actually what she was doing is illegal, because she could be arrested for controlling prostitution, because controlling prostitution includes any kind of organisation like that.
Yeah.
And it sounds like a very serious crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
But people like her could have been targeted for kind of those basic...
Us trying to organise collectively to improve our working conditions means you get criminalised. It puts you more at risk of criminalisation.
So with the wording of those kind of laws... Is it because they don't really know how the industry works, so they don't know how to target them properly, or is it because they don't care? Do you see what I mean? Like, so if technically someone going around saying, actually, we work so hard, and if we all decide, you know, there's inflation, we're now charging this.
Yeah.
The fact that that would come under the same thing as someone who is, I guess, if there is an enemy, and this could be a fictional enemy or a cartoon, but the sense that what you have is someone who is involved in the criminal network anyway. One of the things they do to earn money is to kind of profit from women. They take the money. They don't give very much money. Or people are in some way kind of imprisoned or have debts overhanging them, so they can't leave. So that's what they. That is criminal. We want to target those people. That is exploitation. People can't refuse customers or choose what they do, and they're vulnerable in that way. But the fact that the same wording could apply to both people. Is that because they just don't know how to target those people? Or is it that they don't?
I think they know. I mean, we've fought out in court on the whole issue of what is controlling. I mean, with the same Soho raids, they all went to court as closure orders.
Yeah.
And the women all came to court. You know, the women in our group all came to court and said, I got my job because I literally got the job by turning up at the premises. Mm. I knocked on the door. Somebody opened the door and I said, look, I really need a couple of shifts. And she said, come back on Thursday.
Yeah.
And the magistrate said, that's controlling.
What, saying come back on Thursday?
Yeah.
And inciting.
Yeah. And inciting.
And inciting. You're actually kind of...
By existing.
And they said something like, you know, in relation to prostitution, you are controlled if you admit that you went, you needed the job because you're being controlled by your need for money. I mean, it was just like, it was like a surreal kind of situation.
Yeah.
So I think that they know very well, and I think they know very well that the brothel keeping laws are first and foremost used against women working together from premises where there is no force and coercion.
Yeah.
And if... Otherwise, why don't they just change the law? Why don't they just amend the law, amend the brothel keeping law and say, this applies to people who are forcing and coercing? Because the description you gave, it's a bit of a sliding scale.
Yes.
You know, because the beginning of what you were saying about somebody that is making people work very hard and taking a very big cut of their income, that could actually apply to Mike Ashley and Sports Direct. You know, it's like,
oh, absolutely.
You know, there's a lot of that kind
of... And under capitalism, I mean, this is the structure, is that some people become very rich and other people... And also, it's very interesting with the... I was interviewing someone about fast fashion and the clothing industry because everyone, the majority of people in this country shop at shops where other people in other countries for a very, very, very small wage, sometimes incredibly restrictive living conditions, sleeping on the floor, getting no time off, 7 days a week working. There are things that we would consider slavery, modern slavery, And then we buy those clothes. And I was listening to a podcast about effective altruism. And the argument they used was, don't boycott those shops because those women's other option is sex work. So actually using that morality against people. So like there's a sliding scale of jobs. So very bottom, you've got sex work, and slightly better, factory work, where you don't get a break and you sleep on a cement floor. And that in itself is a Western morality. Go, it's fine to shop at Primark.
Yeah.
Because I'm actually saving women.
Yeah, no. Yes. And in fact, yeah. we work very closely with women in Thailand with a group called Empower, a sex worker collective there. And those women say, you know, we're the women that have worked on the farms. We've worked in the factories. You know, we've worked selling food on the street. And we went into sex work because we can earn a better living. And most are mothers. I mean, I think they estimate like something like 95% of, you know, sex workers are, or 88%. Percent. Yeah. I'm sorry, not so good on my figures, but anyway, somewhere around there, you know, are mums.
Yes.
And, you know, they've actually, I mean, it does turn that kind of whole poor victim upside down
but
on its head.
But also just how we're talking about choice and poverty at all.
Yes.
Because for some people, that's it. It's the way out of that kind of working.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And
choosing.
They are the heads of the household, and they are the ones keeping their whole communities back home. If they've, you know, migrated to the city, they're the ones keeping everything going, buying everything for the whole family, extended family, and they should be given at least, you know, a medal and a lot of money as compensation because they're the ones kind of running the whole country, really.
Yeah. But also I think, and I was thinking about it a lot preparing for these podcasts, it's because sexual crimes are so horrific that it feels like demystifying, being more matter-of-fact about sex as a service seems to then go, and so then what's a sexual assault? Which I don't think, I think there's such different categories.
Totally.
And I think it's like both things can exist at once, including if you're a sex worker who is assaulted.
Yeah.
Is that it isn't minimised or less because at other times you've sold sex or sexual behaviours. And I think that's the thing, is that it's not me going, me thinking that for some people the choice to sell sex is a maybe a more empowering decision, and a choice between that and a different kind of unattractive work or labour, is not to say, and if someone does this to you on a bus, well, that's just a labour, you should have charged them £15. Like, no, no, that's what I mean.
Yeah. I mean, that, the whole flaw in that is that people don't see it from women's point of view. I mean, we know the difference between rape and consent, consenting sex, and we should be trusted to say, I mean, our other grievance with the police is that they don't act on the reports of violence that we give to them. You know, they go on about violence and exploitation in the sex industry, and when sex workers bravely come forward to report violence, the police don't deal with it.
Well, it's seen with women who don't sell sex as well.
Yes,
that,
it is.
The,
so
more,
true.
The more experience you have of sex, the better qualified you should be treated to go, and I know when someone is assaulting me and when something is consensual, but actually it's always used to undermine, like, oh, you're sexually experienced.
Yes.
And then, and that's, and the extreme of that is,
yeah, absolutely. We're actually working with a woman at the moment who was refused, her rape case was refused to be taken forward by the CPS for a few reasons, but one of the reasons was because she advertised a particular service on her website, and then she was raped in a situation, and you're like, it doesn't matter what she was advertising.
No.
She could have been advertising everything, every service there is.
Yes.
If she said no in the moment, that's what counts, surely.
Yes.
And anyway, it's been dismissed.
And women against, we're at the Women's Centre with Women Against Rape, and the horror stories of the way, I mean, non-sex working women.
Yeah.
I mean, we work together often on cases where women are, sex workers are trying to report violence.
Yes.
But there's what you hear about the way that the police deprioritise and, you know, lose the evidence and don't bother to pick up the suspect.
Well, because the legal system's set up so horrendously badly with sex crimes or any crimes involving sex, that they're already so defeatist before they start. So when you talk about the CPS dropping it, they're predicting, they're going, no one's going to believe you. So it doesn't matter if they do, and they won't.
But we did a private prosecution, you know, and we really tackled that head on, because the it was a man that was raping sex workers at knife point.
Yeah.
And one woman came to us after the Crown Prosecution Service had dropped the prosecution against him. And she was frightened because he came back to threaten her and her kids.
Yeah.
And we actually then took a private prosecution. It took 3 years to get the case to court. But we actually got a conviction on exactly the same evidence that the Crown Prosecution Service said was insufficient to prosecute.
Yeah.
And I think there's, it's actually their prejudice. Yes. They may kind of reflect it onto a jury or something like that and say, it's not me, it's them, they'll never convict. But actually, they wouldn't even bring forward the prosecution in the case. You know, they said that the women were unreliable witnesses.
Well, this is what they, and they decide that. So, and again, like you say, with non-working women, perfect victim is a virgin who has bruises and marks all over her body, like who absolutely fought to the death to protect herself. There's all these certain things that go brilliant, because anything a bit more vague, if you happen to be a person who, you know, likes sex and has had a lot of it, or maybe even maybe thought you were going to have sex with this person, like, oh, bad witness, unreliable witness. If you have any kind of mental health difficulties, if you any kind of addiction, all of those things, this unreliable witness rather than,
I think that is all true, but it still doesn't explain why violence generally is, you know, domestic violence. You know, two women a week are killed by their partner or former partner. You know, what it shows that there's a real kind of institutionalized deprioritizing of violence. I mean, the police, I feel like in some cases, the stuff that Women Against Rape's dealing with, you kind of think, okay, that's deliberate. That's not some misguided prejudice or anything like that. That is you deciding that this woman's life, you know, life is not worth it. She has no value. It's not a priority for you to be dealing with it.
Because there's so much overlap, isn't there, between all of these things in terms of, because we're talking about how poor people, autonomy and choice, and then you've got all of the other issues in terms of how we treat women in society and then how the law is then involved in policing women's lives. It's pretty depressing, guys.
No, but our women's centre's lovely. So,
tell me about your women's centre. Tell me about all of the things that your organisation does. So we've talked about Make All Women Safe and those the two kind of strands.
Yeah, well, you say a bit more about that, because that's what we should do first. Mm.
Well, in terms of, what we're doing all the time is women are stopping arrests and stopping deportations and stopping the police coming back to raid them. Those kind of actions are happening all the time, and we are campaigning, and we are getting a lot of support for our Make a Women Safe campaign, and we have a petition which has nearly 12,000 signatures to the government.
So anyone listening who's really interested in this topic should go on your website, but it's also a hashtag, and you can, and people can go and read the petition and sign it to show their
hashtag
involvement.
Make a Women Safe. There's a fantastic film which really explains and highlights the injustice of, you know, even though it's not illegal to be a sex worker, it is illegal to work together, and really shows it in kind of very stark terms, you know, what the impact of that is.
Okay, brilliant. And then tell me about the women's centres.
Yeah, the women's centres in Kentish Town, Crossroads Women's Centre. And the good thing about it is that it's the base for about 15 women's organisations. And it's really good to be, I mean, for us as a sex worker organisation, it's really great to be based at a centre with other women's organisations. Yeah. Number one, because it means that any of us coming and going doesn't automatically get identified as a sex worker just by going to the door. But there's a big group of women asylum seekers, there's Women Against Rape, Black Women's Rape Action Project, there's WinVisible, which is a women with disabilities group who are fighting against universal credit and the way that people with disabilities have been impoverished and attacked and disparaged.
And again, I think being, it's so awful, but being made less visible, less listened to, like in every area, actually.
It's really heartbreaking. You feel like people who need support to be even able to leave their home, and then having all that support cut away is just like people. But there's also a single mothers group, and there's one men's group as well. And I think the good
thing
about,
to have one? we don't hate them. We've let one group been silly.
The good thing about it is that it kind of keeps you going. Yeah. You know, that everybody's fighting their particular battles, but we're all going in the same direction. Yeah. And you feel like, you know, if you're having a bad day or you've had a big defeat, somebody else is winning.
That's great.
And that really kind of keeps you going. And it also helps you kind of keep your mind expanded rather than narrowing down to your own little, you know, issue, you know, because you don't want to kind of be there kind of going, decriminalise prostitution, decriminalise prostitution, you know, when the climate's collapsing and the rest of it. We want to decriminalise prostitution, but we also want other change, and being connected in that way to other groups who are fighting fantastically. It's a real kind of campaigning women's centre.
That's absolutely brilliant. That is just such a positive thing to think about. And I think it's great to name all of those organisations. So if anyone listening is interested, they'll all have websites.
Yeah,
and
it's the Crossroads Women's Centre.
But I was going to ask about our current government. Because the coalition government and now the Tories have been they've been terrible in cutting funding for things that, so like rape centres or support for women who've experienced domestic violence. All these kind of areas were very easy to go, okay, and it wasn't huge amounts of money they were getting in the first place. They're underfunded already, but now organisations like yourself presumably have to do a lot of fundraising as well.
Yeah, and also things like cutting refuges, it's so cruel. It's just brutal. I mean, you know, it was already difficult for women who are escaping domestic violence to find somewhere to go with their kids, and not being, knowing that you're not going to really struggle to support yourself and be safe and keep your kids safe is such a deterrent to leaving that kind of violent situation. Yeah. And for the government to cut funding to those kind of services is, just cruel. And it's infuriating. I mean, we met with some government people about the whole issue of survival sex. And when you sit down with them, they do a little spiel about how much they care about women and safety and everything. And you just want to shout at them, like, why did you cut the refuges then?
Well, can you? I mean, why did they shut the refuges? I mean, because presumably, again, it's just that they're, like with the disabled people, they've cut the very small amount of money, but because it's the people you hear least complaining because they're not in a position to.
Yeah.
I mean, the Universal Credit as well, they told us that in relation to more women going into prostitution because of the Universal Credit completely cutting women's money, their kind of answer was, we have created however many jobs nationally. It's like that answer bears no relation to the problem that you know, the jobs are national. You're not, they're talking about a particular area. It doesn't matter where the jobs are, if they actually even exist, if they're actually decent jobs. It's just
a quarter of women are on less than the minimum wage. I know Esther McVeigh actually said when she was confronted about the survival sex, she said, well, those women could get other jobs. And you're going to go, well, you know, which world are you living in?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think also it's a very important moment for us in relation to this government and any government that may come in soon, is because with the Make All Women Safe campaign, the moment we're at now is that the Home Affairs Select Committee, which is a very prestigious parliamentary committee, recommended that sex workers on the street and in premises should be decriminalised immediately.
Yeah.
And they also said, government, you do some research about the nature and extent of prostitution. That research is due to be published soon. And it's that moment that we want to kind of seize the time and say, okay, whatever research you've done, here's the evidence that decriminalisation makes women safer, makes sex workers safer. And, you know, the Make All Women Safe campaign, we've got all these people that have signed the petition. Now's the time to change the law to allow sex workers to work together on the street and in premises and do something about the criminal records. And it is based on the New Zealand model, except one bit of the New Zealand model, which targets migrant sex workers, discriminates against migrant sex workers, and we don't want that.
That's because they don't have legal citizenship, is that why?
It made it an illegal offence. It made it an offence to come into the country in order to do sex work. And so it's given the police an occasion to target migrant sex workers. And so we definitely don't want that because we want to get rid of that whole kind of policing involvement. The police should not be involved in prostitution.
Yeah.
You know, they just get the criminal laws off our back.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much for coming to talk to me. Sorry for how many things I got wrong. But it was so great to have someone go, no, that's the difference, and say thank you so much and best of luck with everything.
Thank you very much. That's lovely.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends. Thank you so much to Nikki and Laura. If you enjoyed what they were talking about or you'd like to find out more, please seek out the English Collective of Prostitutes online. Please watch their video and share their petition and help support them as they campaign for the decriminalisation of sex work. Next week, I'll be joined by Alex Faisbryce, the founding CEO of Ugly Mugs. If you don't know what that is, please tune in next week to find out.